Good morning, and welcome to the Roundtable panel for this Tuesday morning. It is the 20th of June, and it's very nice to have you all with us. Thank you for being with us. As Mike described it, how did you describe it, Mike? Is it sort of the nicest day we've had so far? Is
it? Well, it's not awful like yesterday.
We'll take
it. By comparison, it's a beautiful day.
That's right. We'll
take
it.
It is nice.
Well, good morning. Let me introduce the panel. I will lay out a couple of ground rules for letters and then give you the address, and then you can join us, and then we'll actually start talking about things that are going on in the world today. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Joe. I'm fine, but I think this coffee cup has a little bit of a leak in it.
Oh.
I'm not sure. But, well, anyway.
But that's a WAMC First Amendment coffee cup. How could it have a flaw in it?
Gee, what could possibly be happening to
the— Is this a metaphor for something that's happening to our free speech rights?
Yeah, what could possibly be happening to our amendments?
This is a wonderful child here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Liz. Aren't you nice? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wow.
It's being replaced with another First
Amendment.
Yeah,
apparently we're going to change out the vessel. Good morning, Alan. Very nice to have you here. Associate editor of the Times Union newspaper, Mike Spain, who joins us each and every Tuesday, and we are thrilled to have him. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How are you? And publisher of the Empire Report, J.P. Miller, who will be joining us each and every Tuesday from now on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right. So when it comes to writing letters, keep them short and keep them to the point. Also, don't include wings because we can't click them on the air. Don't use abbreviations because you may know what they mean. We don't.
Or the links might bite you.
Yeah. Yes. That.
Don't you see?
Yes. Okay. Spelled in a different way, but yes. And, you know, just maybe proofread before you send, so make sure it has verbs and we can actually read it and know what you're saying.
And make sure your machine hasn't changed a word which
That's
you
right.
meant into
spell
something
That's
else.
Right. So just a quick look. I know you're sending them off, but we want to, you know, the purity of the radio program, after all. So panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll go there. You know, there's so many things to talk about, but all I really want to talk about is Jim Acosta. Boy, he's just my hero now. Did you see this yesterday?
No.
Okay. Did anyone see this yesterday? Mike, did you see Jim Acosta?
Tell us.
Okay. So Jim Acosta is a CNN reporter, and he went into the press briefing yesterday. They were told they couldn't record it. They couldn't video record it. They couldn't do anything with it. They could only take notes.
Yeah, it's the new thing.
Yeah. And so then he said he had sort of a mini meltdown on the air when he was doing his wrap up with Brooke Baldwin on the show. And he said, look, if Sean Spicer can't come out and answer the questions and they're just not going to do this on camera or audio, why are we even having these briefings or these gaggles in the first place? And then Baldwin started to ask if Spicer was even having conversations with the president about subjects. And he said, that's a really good question, and it's a question I would ask. But unfortunately, at this White House, we wouldn't have any video or audio proof of an answer to this question because of the stonewalling we're getting over here.
And because they're lying liars.
I don't know why everybody is going along with this. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And it just feels that we're sort of slowly but surely being dragged into what is a new normal in this country where the president of the United States of America is allowed to insulate himself from answering hard questions.
It isn't the first time the president has avoided meeting with the press. I think the last 2 years of Nixon's presidency, I think he might have had one press conference.
He mentioned the press conference, but also just the daily press briefings. And if you're going to have them, and if you can't put any of it on the record, then why do it, right?
Well, a broader story here is that the White House is rethinking and revamping its whole approach to communications.
Yes. So this is all my way of getting to Sean Spicer is out of a job. Well, out of that job.
We don't really know. This is not the first time we've heard that Sean Spicer is out of a job and that he's going to be replaced.
Yeah, I think you had him down in the pool, Joe, for like February 20th or something.
I had March 19th, okay. I lost. Yes.
So what is it about Sean Spicer that gives him all of those nine lives, despite the fact that he's obviously terrible at his job, has been imitated, Saturday Night Live has made a complete fool out of him during this time? It's a pathetic sort of He's a pathetic sort of creature.
Well, they can't fire him because he's been on the inside, I think, too long and probably knows too much. And the first senior staffer that leaves the White House is going to get an unbelievable book deal and make a lot of money. And Sean Spicer seems like a guy who could really benefit from that. On the daily press briefings, I imagine that the White House just does not want the daily press briefings to be what drives the news that day. And it's become kind of a distraction. I think that the White House likes this woman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who tends to not make news like Spicer does, and they're going to try and keep Spicer in the fold, giving him a quote-unquote senior-level position, which everybody kind of realizes is a demotion.
So what the Associated Press is reporting is that he will run the communications department, but he will not be the person who will actually be out front and center behind the podium, and that most likely will be Sarah Huckabee Sanders, although they are interviewing. They said Ryan Priebus and Sean Spicer are both interviewing for that job as to who would take over that position.
And they're looking like crazy for a famous person who could do it and lend some credibility.
Laura Ingraham being one of the people.
She declined, according to this.
Yes.
Associated Press.
Well, I think the big problem with the Trump administration, which is going down, 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 is that everybody knows that, you know, you're signing on to a sinking ship. So I think they're having a lot of problems filling these jobs.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Being press secretary is a hard job under any president of the United States and is 10 times as hard under this president because you never know whether what you're saying is going to be challenged and rebuked by your boss 5 minutes later on a tweet. And so your number one job as a press secretary is to represent the president and to represent the message. That message is changing by the hour and by the day. And It is a tough job, especially under Trump, to do it well and represent Trump and also keep your own credibility.
So, JP, the question I have for you is, what is that all about? In other words, why is the message keep changing? Why does he obviously check before he goes out there, gets his orders, and then the guy contradicts him? Does that mean the president—
Is that a rhetorical question? I just have to.
Yes, it is. I'm thinking that the president may be crazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no reality.
Well, one of the observations I think a lot of people have made is that the president will say something or do something. It might be a tweet or it might be a comment he makes or an action he takes, like firing the head of the FBI. And then the spokespeople, you know, Sanders and Spicer and others, come out and try to put it in a context and try to explain it in a way. Well, no, he was just taking the recommendation of a deputy attorney general in this matter. And oh, it was because of the way that Comey treated Hillary Clinton unfairly during the presidential campaign. Then the president goes on TV on NBC, with Holt.
Lester Holt,
right?
And
he says, oh, no, it's because of the Russian thing. I want to stop it. You know, I mean, it's a very, very difficult job with any president, probably twice as difficult with this president.
Also, one of the things that Jim Acosta was bringing up is what is the level of interaction between the two. So this, I think Alan made this point as well, where you say, okay, we have a question about where does the – some of them I think are silly questions like about the taping system or about what's the answer to that? Is there a taping system? Well, we'll get back to you. Okay. And then yesterday they said, well, is there a taping system? And they said, well, we'll get back to you. Well, okay. Well, are you ever going to answer the question? And isn't that a simple yes or no question? Same thing with are you under an investigation, which they also have difficulty with. On more serious matters like climate change, or does the president believe that the planet is warming? That also, well, I'll get back to you.
We'll get back to you on that.
And warming. Hmm.
Yeah, and I'm.
Yesterday
gonna...
I would have said yes. Today not so much.
Right. I needed a parka yesterday. Today, the little light sweater. So I don't know. And you. So his point was, but if you can't get any answer and there isn't any communication between those two, and he seems to be off the list, and yet he's the. Sean Spicer is the person who's going out and talking to the press. Lately, he's just been saying, I don't know the answer to that. I'll find out. I don't know the answer to that. I'll find out. And he's trying to kick the can down the road, but he's never finding out any of the answers. So it does, to the point that Jim Acosta was making, it's kind of senseless then, isn't it?
But even here in Albany, where, you know, we who've worked in Albany have dealt with many, many press people in the government.
Where things
office.
Are much more functional and they're running.
Oh, they are, by all means. By any comparison, right, to the White House. But you know, sometimes they're very low-key. They say they'll get back to you. If you call a state agency with a minor question, I called one a couple of weeks ago to get an answer for an editorial we were doing. It was just one minor question. How do prisoners make a phone call today? Do they do a collect call, or is it done a different way? Because it used to be under a lot of criticism because they were getting really overcharged by these contractors to make a phone call, et cetera, et cetera. I just wanted the answer. It took about 4 or 5 phone calls, and I never got an answer. Then finally, like an hour after I went home, I got an email from their spokesman saying, collect calls.
You know? Well, except...
you know, except, it just shows you that those kinds of things can happen at every level, except when it's so much at stake.
Well, both Pataki and young Cuomo have certain rules here, which are nobody talks. Right. You know, everything goes through the second floor, which is where the governor sits.
That's exactly right. I think you're right. Yeah.
So it may have taken 4 hours to get up to the top.
Oh, no, unquestionably. And by trying to control everything and controlling the message, a lot of message doesn't get out, and they lose an opportunity to promulgate policy. I mean, that's what really a spokesman does for a state agency or a federal agency, is they help to get the message out that the, you know, whatever environmental protection or, you know, the Treasury Department, whatever it is, they're trying to get the message out, explain it in plain English and defend it. And if you don't bring them into the inner circle of the administration or of the commissioner, whoever it is, of the secretary, whatever department it is, and they don't understand the context of it, and they're not trusted, and there's not a trusting relationship between a press secretary and their boss, that's where it breaks down. And
not only that, yeah. But it gets even worse than that, because what I have seen in my many, many, many years being alive is, and in this,
just thing, in general, being alive.
Yeah, whatever.
In my many years, I have seen that the press secretary who delivers the message for either the president or the governor or the mayor ends up getting it in the neck because the guy at the top has made a stupid move. The press secretary is always blamed for the way people perceive it when it's ridiculous,
and they feel out of the loop. Yeah.
They feel out of the loop. You can make the case that the press secretary is there to get out the president's message. You could also make the case that the press secretary is there to take arrows and take machete wax from the press, who are out there to bloody the administration and bloody Sean Spicer. And him not going on camera and being recorded, the press gripes about it, understandably so, and maybe it's not right, but the story yesterday wasn't Sean Spicer got bloodied on this question and that question. It's that he, refused to answer questions. So they may say this is not a good story, but it could have been a lot worse if he got up there in front of the cameras yesterday.
So the question would be, what is Saturday Night Live going to do with this? In other words, here's the non-existing press gaggle or press conference or whatever is going on. I'm sure they're hard at work trying to figure out some kind of ghost story about all of this.
Well, they won't be back till October.
Right. So they have a lot
to happen.
They
got a lot of time to figure out
what's
going on.
What's that about that they're not back till October?
That's
not
right. The season.
That's not right.
Yeah, their next season.
That isn't right.
But the question also is, the positions that he's put in,
You mean Sean Spicer?
Yeah, you feel a little sorry for the guy.
Because
there's a reason that a grown man hides in the bushes, right? I mean, there has to be a reason that he is so afraid of violating whatever the rules are that he puts himself and is put in these very precarious
positions.
So you have
to be a masochist, is I think what you're saying, to take a job like that.
Well yeah.
You have to be loyal, I guess.
And to the point that JP made earlier, when does that straw break the camel's back and you say, all right, I'm out of here and I'm willing to tell everything I know?
Well, just remember right after the inauguration when he was out there defending the crowd, at the inauguration. He was
That was our introduction to him.
He was talking about how many people took the subway, you know, or the metro system in Washington, D.C. on the day of Obama's first inauguration versus how many were in the system that day. And that's just one more proof. And he looked so tortured trying to defend something that it sounded like he didn't believe at all. And then they went on one of the cable stations to Ari Fleischer, who was for Bush 2, you know, George W. Bush, in his White House, and he says, "That is a man who is being told what to say by his boss." You know, yeah, and that's really all it is.
Well, it hasn't gotten better in that regard.
No. It was clear from that first press conference how challenging a job that Sean Spicer would have. And you know, in hindsight, let's see a couple other press secretaries go and work for Trump and see how they do. And maybe in hindsight, we'll say Spicer was the best one of the two or three or four that end up working for Trump.
We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have some letters, then we're going to get on to some other issues. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org.
Dwight says, "Panel, I would like to hear more discussion about major issues of the day, in other words, North Korea treatment of Otto Warmbier. What are we going to do in response? Collision of a Navy destroyer and container ship. How the heck did that happen? And the shooting down of the Syrian plane, the Russians' response. Will we stand our ground?"
Well, we talked about all of that yesterday with the exception of Otto Warmbier, which we'll talk about as our next topic.
Yeah, exactly. Paul says, "They're dumb. TV reporters need someone to go on camera. They'll just find someone else, and the White House loses control of their message if there is one yet again." That's from Paul, who knows about these things. So Alan is a leaker. Way to go, sir. It has to do with the First Amendment coffee.
Yes, your coffee mug, which has been replaced.
It has been.
Repealed and replaced.
Nice joke. Very nice.
Brian says,
"I wonder if the White House hasn't placed restrictions on recording the press briefings to ensure that any record be a written account, which would render it less likely to be reviewed by the president. If it was recorded either in audio or video format, then the president might hear or see it on TV."
That's
you write them, we read them. And
there's probably something to that.
Yeah.
Could be.
Maybe not. And
maybe the other taping system will pick up this briefing.
Nurse Carol, "Hi, panel. Love the show. Mr. Spicer has lasted this long because as long as he was there, Trump, et cetera, always had someone else to blame for getting it wrong. In addition, the more airtime folks such as SNL give Spicer, the less time is left to mock and lambaste the president. Thank you all." From Carol.
Good points.
We welcome your letter, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I do want to get to the story of Otto Warmbier. Before that, however, let's talk about the election that's taking place in Georgia, the Georgia special election. High stakes, a lot of money being put into this race in Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. And will the Democrat win? Will the Republican win? And there are two people who are running for this. It's been a hard-fought battle. According to the polls, it seems to be neck and neck. And it's Karen Handel, who is the Republican, and John Ossoff, who is the Democrat.
30 years old and living outside the district. Now, that's dumb, isn't it?
Dumb.
I mean, if you're going to find somebody to run, now, I suspect when he found himself or did what he had to do, I think what happened was he knew, it was a different story than now. But now, you know, living outside the district, it's been done before, and tons and tons and tons of Bernie-like money from Democrats all over the country, putting in just a little, to the point where it's now the most expensive presidential election gubernatorial election in history. It's extraordinary. Now, he did run originally, but he had to go by just a little. He had to go into a runoff because of the way that they
do
it.
But he almost won clear and
that's right.
Free. I mean, he might have been elected if he had a little bit of this money before that.
Too bad, because that's not the way it works.
Yeah.
And now, as has been mentioned, the polls are evening up. The Republicans have a respectable candidate, former Secretary of State, as a matter of fact, for the state. The downside, of course, is that they are this is not about her. This is about Trump. People are voting against Trump. So the question is, are there enough of them? Now, you look at the polls and you see that the polls are suggesting that, the Republicans all over, 80% of them are sticking with Trump. That's extraordinary.
I think the Republicans are sticking with Trump. On this special election, though, people are trying to read the tea leaves as to what this election is going to mean for 2018. The fact that they are running in the seat to replace Tom Price. Tom Price, just a few months ago, won by 23 points.
Yes.
And now the polls are saying it's neck and neck. So in my opinion, whether the Republican wins or loses this election, the Republicans as a whole have lost. So they're down 20 points or whatever from what they were just a couple months ago on this congressional race.
Yeah, but I didn't want to interrupt you. But if that happens, wouldn't they rather have won than have lost by a little, the Democrats?
The Republicans, both the Democrats and the Republicans, want to win. What I think is, even if the Republicans win by a little, it's still really overall a loss for
them. You're right, of course. Nevertheless, right.
Should the Democrat win in this district, which, by the way, Trump only won it by 1% during the full election.
So, and Trump tweeted three times yesterday about this race.
Yeah, and there's a good question on whether his endorsement of the Republican candidate helps her or hurts her. And I think everybody there is well aware of the stakes. And this is, and even Republicans around the country are saying that this is a referendum on the Trump administration. And if the Republicans were to lose it, Alan, I think what you have said in the past would happen. It would begin the tipping point where it'd be every man for himself, as this one characterization put it. And Republicans would begin to feel like they have to do what they have to do to win in their own districts, and that is, distancing themselves from the president.
And you can just see, Mike, what's going to happen
when
the White House says, the president would be happy to come in and campaign for you. No, stay away.
Well, and you think things can't get uglier. There is an ad that is running in this particular race that started to run yesterday that shows the House Majority Whip Steve Scalise on a stretcher after the shooting last week, along with the sounds of gunshots, with the narrator saying the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans. When will it stop? It won't if John Ossoff wins on Tuesday. And then it shows several images of Kathy Griffin and says, resist the fascist takeover, string up the collaborators, and says these same leftists are all for Ossoff, and if he wins, they win. Stop John Ossoff. Stop Nancy Pelosi. Vote Karen Handel for Congress.
You never know. That could backfire. That could actually help.
I can't imagine how it couldn't backfire.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you're using, first of all, this line, the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans.
Here's the problem. Everybody in this room says, well, we can't understand how that would not hurt them by doing it. I'll tell you how it doesn't. 5% or 10%. Or 2% in an election like this who believe that kind of garbage, that's what wins it for them.
It's turnout. And right now the Republican base is not as jazzed up as the Democratic base. And an ad like that might just do enough to jazz up the Republican base and say we need to keep these
But I want to go back to what Joe said, because it's so interesting to me that you don't have to you don't have to get everybody. All you have to do in these elections is get 2% or 3% and you win, because it's going to be a close one. And are there 2 or 3% of people who, as you say, JP, would be sitting on their keisters and say, that's really terrible what those lefty commie pinkos are doing over there. We got to get out and we got to vote.
It's all about turnout. I remember back when President Obama was elected and there was an open seat for U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, and a Republican named Scott Brown won a Senate seat in Massachusetts. No one would have ever thought a Republican would have won
or should have won
a Senate seat in Massachusetts. But the nature of politics is that when the Republicans are in power, the Democrat base is fired up and gets to elect people, and the same is true on the opposite hand.
But it's interesting. I live in Massachusetts, which is a wonderful state, I want to say. But you see it all the time in which the people, it's a blue, 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 blue state, but the people say, hey, enough of this garbage. Don't give us garbage. We're going to elect a Republican just to show you.
Right. That might be what's going on here in Georgia. There might be some element of, don't just give me the same old, same old. I'll make a protest vote. I'll vote for Ossoff, and that'll put shutters through the entire GOP around the country. And I think it will. I think it will. I think it'll shake a lot of people if they do not win.
If it happens.
Yeah. If I had to put my money down, my sense is that she'll probably edge out. The Republican will win.
I was just about to say, here, put the dollar on the table.
Put the dollar.
Because I wasn't going to take the position you took. I think the chances are that...
JP, where are you going to... You're going to bet on this one. Is there money on the table?
I think I would want to go where the momentum is. I would probably vote on the Democrat to win. But I also think that it's possible that there are Republican voters that are so disgusted with that the Republican Congress hasn't passed a single bill. The fact that they have the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they haven't passed a single bill. There may be some Republicans that say, why are we even voting for you people? Why not put in a Democrat?
Too intellectual. I think that's too intellectual. I don't think that's the way that works. Oh, they haven't passed.
All they need is a couple of percent to think that way.
There's a new poll, the latest poll, the CBS poll that came out of Atlanta, that was released this morning going into this race. It just shows it to be completely a squeaker. But there's a couple little interesting facts in here. Ossoff leads handle 49.0% to 48.9%. Okay,
that's
so that's
pretty close.
0.1%.
Not close enough. Not good enough for Ossoff.
With 2.1% undecided and a 4.4% margin of error. So, in other words, who the hell knows? However, to this point about turnout and what would make people go out to vote, this is what I found interesting. 46% of Republicans said last week, the events last week, make them more likely to vote, where just 24% of Democrats say the events of last week make them more likely to vote.
So that's an interesting analysis.
I think if it's a one-point race right now with the climate that we're in with Donald Trump, I think Ossoff wins by a couple percent.
And my father used to say to me, Alan, never vote against yourself, against your own interests. But I think I'm with Mike on this. I think the chances are it's a Republican district. Ossoff is 30 years old. There has never been a Democratic congressman in that district during his entire life. Isn't that an astounding
Well, you know who the winner already is on this? It's the local Atlanta area television and radio stations.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure the newspapers didn't do too bad either.
Well, I don't know. They don't get as much. Usually it's a war on the air on commercial radio stations.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some letters and talk about other issues as well. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. This morning, we welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, and that is where we receive letters like these.
Just a couple this time. The message is out from the Trump administration, loud and clear, says Jerome, a big middle finger. The ACA is more of the same. They are playing three-card Monte with the press and public, profiting from the confusion. Okay.
All right.
And then we heard from Naomi, who said, hey, guys, where are the gals?
They were here yesterday, and many will be back tomorrow. But today, the way the wheel landed, we got Mike and JP.
And are we lucky?
We are lucky. Okay, let's go to another story and a couple of things that I want to talk about. We were mentioning the Otto Warmbier story. It is a tragic story. He died yesterday after his release from North Korean detention. He was a University of Virginia student who was detained in North Korea for nearly a year and a half. Died Monday afternoon, just days after he returned home in a coma. 22 years old, had been medically evacuated last week and was treated at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. His parents made clear in a written statement that they blame North Korea for what happened. Their son was arrested in January 2016 at the end of a brief tourist visit to the isolated country. So the story there was he was over with a bunch of college students. He was
into China,
as part of a tour. And what will often happen, there was a poster there and kind of a propaganda poster.
I think
poster.
It was in his hotel room, wasn't it?
It was in the lobby or something like that, or was it in his room? I don't know.
They had a videotape of him taking it down.
He took it, and they sentenced him to 15 years of hard labor. Then since that time, and they believe that he's been in a coma for almost a year.
Yeah, 2016.
Yes, so... and there
no brain tissue left. I mean, the brain tissue issue.
Right. So issue then the president said in a statement, "There's nothing more tragic for a parent than to lose a child in the prime of his life. Our thoughts and prayers with without his family and friends who all loved him." Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said in a statement, "Otto Warmbier, an American citizen, was murdered by the Kim Jong-un regime in the final year of his life. He lived the nightmare in which the North Korean people have been trapped for 70 years, forced labor, mass starvation, systematic cruelty, torture, and murder." Help me out here, folks, esteemed members of the panel. So the debate now in Washington is whether we should restrict travel to North Korea. Now, okay. So I'm thinking to myself, yeah, that seems like a pretty good idea, right?
Good advice. I would not advise anybody I know to go there.
So help me out with the other side there.
The parents said in their own defense, this kid has always been a very bright, level-headed guy. When he said he wanted to go to North Korea, we didn't agree, basically, but we certainly weren't going to tell him he couldn't do it, something that we parents have faced over our lifetimes, because we raise our kids and we want them to exercise their own judgment. However, there's a part of me that, have you noticed this, Mike and JP and Joe, that isn't very nice? I get that? Did you hear what I said? There's a part of me that isn't very nice, if you notice that. Joe's nodding.
I noted. Let me just sit down.
So I keep thinking, here's Trump. He's the president of the United States, and all kinds of people, maybe 3-4%, 2% more, had voted for him and gone out and got it off their, you know, their cans and gone out and voted. Trump wouldn't be the president right now. See what I mean?
Well, that's happened before, you know.
Well, it's happened before, but I keep thinking, you know, the people who are really going to get screwed under this Health Care Act didn't go out and vote in large numbers.
I think that's the dynamic we were just talking about in relationship to the Georgia House race. There are different things that motivate people or make people condescending and complacent or whatever that doesn't get them out to vote. It's just the dynamic of things.
But I was going to go back, Joe, for one second. Yeah. I was going to go back to the Ossoff thing.
Right.
I mean, North Korea? You're going to go to North Korea when you know what they do over there? When you know that every particle in their brains is to annoy the hell out of everybody and to scare you as much as they can, and you're going to go and you're going to take a chance over there?
It's a tour company that was bringing kids. It's
from China. I mean, they sort of
based
themselves
in China.
Young
Pioneer Tours, right. And now they say they will no longer take American citizens
to
North Korea, which seems like good marketing. My question is that as those in the House and Senate say that they are going to work on passing this, and I guess even Rex Tillerson came out and said that there would possibly be an executive order that would prohibit travel to North Korea.
It doesn't apply to ex-NBA players, though.
So what is the other side to that? What do we benefit in allowing tourists to go to
how about journalists?
Okay.
I mean, let's say Megyn Kelly in her next big interview gets to go to North Korea and interview Kim Jong-un and with a translator there. Do you think she wouldn't jump at the opportunity to get inside and portray all that? I mean, it's a mysterious place. As John McCain pointed out, they haven't really changed their policy towards the Americans in like 65 years, you know, and it really. I'm curious about it. I mean, any kind of insider look at that regime and the whole way that it works is fascinating. And do you remember there was a little bit of softening at the end of the Clinton administration?
Yeah.
Madeleine Albright went there, I believe, didn't she? And she, as the Secretary of State, and there was some effort to negotiate some kind of a communication between the U.S. and South Korea, or North Korea, rather. And it just fizzled, of course, when Bush got in there.
And then there's another question. How are we going to get our spies in there? Because every time we start talking, everybody says, we need more assets on the ground. You know what that means? It means we've got to get our spies in. So how are you going to get your spies in there
Well, that happens regardless if right?
I mean, no.
That's why I meant what's what makes them spies.
No. No, because you see, they have to have a nom de plume. They have to have some rationale for getting them in there. No?
I can't believe that we don't have a travel ban to that country. And I think anybody that wants to go there, any American should have to sign a document saying, I realize that the United States is not going to come and try and rescue me. Because what happens is people get trapped over there, and then we spend money and American lives trying to get them out. And it's a waste.
You know,
and the one guy that should be allowed over there is Dennis Rodman. There are three people, I think, that are still trapped over there. Dennis Rodman is a guy that can handle himself in North Korea with these people. And I think he should come, go over there, grab the three people that are still there, and bring them back, and don't send another person over there to North Korea. I can't imagine why you'd want to go. But as the parents, yes, if my kid wanted to, hey, I really want to go, I'd have a hard time saying no.
Well, you got to admire people's sort of fortitude to go somewhere and you know, what if you had a child that wanted to go to Antarctica or go to climb Mount Everest? You know, you'd probably be terribly nervous about it, but it's a courageous thing to go somewhere where you're exposed to danger, where there might be some value coming out of it, a better understanding of this weird place.
North Korea. I don't blame the kid. I mean, you're 22 years old.
Yeah.
You're on a tour.
He was idealistic. He was an outstanding student. I mean, you know, and you'd want to go and learn. You know, and I think there's a lot you can learn about it. And you know, something has to break the ice, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen now. The interesting thing to me, though, is that when he was first released last week, when he was medic-backed out of North Korea and heading back home, the family said, we tried to get some action and got nowhere with the Obama administration,
right.
And they thank the White House. I don't know. Does this mean that Trump has a little bit of influence with North Korea? I didn't quite understand that.
I do think that a story like this is something that appeals to Trump's animal instincts. I think this thing has really gotten him upset when a time when we do not need escalation with North Korea. And I think, unfortunately, this is going to escalate things, especially with Trump.
JP, do you really mean gotten him upset, or do you really mean that he's an opportunist who saw an opportunity?
I think that this kind of thing, he is a nationalist, and I think this kind of thing where they take a poor, innocent, bright high school kid and they beat him up to the point of being in a coma and send him back in a coma and he dies a couple days later, that is a middle finger to Trump, and Trump does not like that kind of thing. And I think he's doing his best to restrain himself not to really get upset with North Korea.
Trump was tweeting about the difference between his administration and the Obama administration, that they at least got him home and so forth. So, I mean, I think to your instinct point, yeah, but there's the North Korea thing, but there's also the, oh, I have a chance to get Obama as well, right?
Yeah, there's the delicious part of it
which
when
is
you
pretty
can put
sick,
Obama down. Yeah.
Which is pretty sick in itself, this obsession with
wasn't
Obama.
Wasn't there a story around right after the election when Trump went to the White House where Obama said, you know, the Middle East is a big problem. That's a big problem here, a big problem there. But the thing I lose sleep over and the thing you'll lose sleep over is North Korea, the uncertainty of North Korea. I mean, it is because they have nuclear weapons.
And what can you do about North Korea? I mean, you know, you're all bright people. Everybody who's listening is bright. And you say, okay, what would I
Most
do?
Of them.
What would the sanctions be? What'd you say, Joe?
Most of them.
All of them.
I went to a speech 2 weeks ago by a former by a former CIA director who did a whole 20 minutes on North Korea, and his conclusion was, I can't get into all of the things that he said, but he said there is no military solution with North Korea and there is no diplomatic solution with North Korea. It is just a mess, and it's going to continue to be a mess.
I remember the 96 campaign. We got to go to news. In the 96 campaign, you mentioned this, but Clinton was running for re-election, and Tim Russert, who was then host of Meet the Press, now departed, but was hosting Meet the Press, and he said, you know, in 92, it's the economy stupid, and he said, in this election, it's going to be, it's North Korea stupid. And that was in 1996. So, I mean, 20 years later, we're looking at this as a very big mess.
But of course, very quickly, if they do lose a bomb, or if they do wipe something out, there's going to be hell to pay. And it may well be that that's going to be the resolution, because Kim Jong-un makes his move. And as a result of that, he gets himself into a lot of trouble. And then there's a military confrontation, and millions of people could die.
Stand by for news. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 20th of June. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Shartok is here. Mike Spain, J.P. Miller. I'm Joe Donahue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We have a couple more topics to get into. First, we'll go to some letters, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
All right. Dear panel, I struggle with an appropriate response to this completely outrageous tragedy. I'm talking about a warm beer. The young man was used as a proxy to strike back on a very personal level against the United States and the administration. This was torture. The response must be unequivocally forceful, short of military intervention, of course. From Catherine.
Yeah, we can cut them off.
Yeah, like what?
Diplomatically. I don't know what else you can do. Barbara, I mean, that's the dilemma.
Barbara took some umbrage at my thoughts about John Ossoff living outside of the district, and says he grew up in the district and he lives 2 miles outside in order for his fiancée to be able to walk to her internship at the hospital. Said voters not that concerned, as he is supporting his fiancée. And that's from Barbara. Okay. Thank you, Barbara. James says, in 1989, the U.S. treated the head of the state of Panama, Noriega, as a common criminal, charged him with drug trafficking, invaded his country, removed him from office, arrested and tried him, convicted and imprisoned him. So there is a precedent for treating Kim Jong-un as a common criminal and charging him for the murder of Otto Warmbier and the imprisonment of the other Americans. We won't invade North Korea, but can impose massive sanctions, seize, destroy North Korean assets, et cetera, outside of North Korea, and make an international criminal. That's from James.
Yeah, he might become a pariah then.
Stacy says, Joe, I think your empathy for Sean Spicer is misplaced, and you are falling to the Trumps, we are victims poor, as everyone is ganging us up on us a trap. Sean Spicer is a grown man who appears not to have an ounce of self-respect, or he should have found a new job months ago. No pity for him, Stacy.
Oh, I disagree. I mean, I agree. I 99% agree. My point was about the Pope thing.
No, I agree with you, Joe.
Which just seemed mean.
No,
mean?
I think.
What? What else? What? like a healthcare plan? Never mind. That's another.
Well,
story.
That's right. Good point. Thank you, Mike.
He's a schlemiel. Sean Spicer is a schlemiel.
Yeah.
Or at very worst, a schlemazel. Schlemiel gets the soup poured on him. And
do we have a Yiddish translator available in the room?
I don't know. Or a Laverne and Shirley expert.
Okay. We did that one already. John Lewis asked Ossoff to run, says Christine.
I think we did that one, too.
Dems are doing with the people they are asking to step up to run. I have made calls for his campaign. Fingers crossed, John wins. Jeff says, These inflammatory ads running in Georgia, they don't need to be factual. They just need to instill enough hatred of other to compel the GOP base to vote for spite. And that's Jeff in Pleasant Valley, where everybody smiles. And Betsy says, a couple of things, panel. This election is all about health care. People in the district don't care more about this than the Trump issue. They don't want people thrown off the rolls. Are they moderate Republicans? Also, they are moderate Republicans for the most part. The other thing that is underreported here is that there is no paper trail. What if there is a recount? How do we know that the polls are not a target for Russian or other hackers? Betsy.
Do you think there's any Russian influence in the Georgia House race? That's what I'd like to know.
Why not?
You never know. Elizabeth says, with due respect to the inimitable and irreplaceable Allen, while it is undoubtedly true that not enough people, don't forget.
Where's this one headed?
Is there a Yiddish word for this?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it is undoubtedly true that not enough people.
I think the soup's being poured on right now. Go ahead.
Don't forget that many people who will be hurt by the new health care plan did vote for Trump. And don't forget that this was the first election since the 60s that took place without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. The story of voter suppression in the 2016 election is underreported. As you say, it only takes a few percentage points in the right places to turn an election. Yes, that's true. But we do know that many, you know, remember everybody that only 50% of the people in this country vote in a presidential election, around 50%. And we do know that the people who have the greatest assets are more likely to vote than the people who are, you know, struggling.
But the ballot access issue is a good one.
Yes, it
is. People who work wage and hour jobs can't take time off from work on a Tuesday. If they could have voted by mail or voted over the weekend and all that, you'd probably get more participation from people who have difficulty getting out.
That's all true, Mike. No question, but if you take a look at that 50% that don't vote, you will find that many people who have the most to lose don't vote. And I'm sorry, I'm not picking on anybody. I'm just saying there's a part of me that says, hey, get out there and exercise the franchise no matter what. You know what I mean?
Well, many people would say it's a candidate's responsibility to excite those people. And some would argue, not me, but some would argue that Hillary Clinton couldn't quite excite those people who are most vulnerable. Some people would say that.
I see. Okay. That's good. Okay. And Jeff says, good morning, panel. Say that there is no military solution in North Korea isn't entirely accurate. As Japan found out in World War II, if America is pushed too hard, there is a dizzying capability of obliteration beyond the U.S. military, and North Korea could be gone tomorrow if we wanted it to be. You think they might send up a few things of their own that are now, we think, capable of hitting California, Japan, and some of these other places? Yeah, all true. Good morning, Roundtable.
Anyone wants that.
Go ahead, Alan. I need someone to say it. It is us. It's U.S. No, it's us, U.S., the African-American community, that there was a lot of black voters that did not vote for one stupid reason or another. I would like somehow someone to come out on your show and talk about the reasons. Also in the military, you would not believe how many of us didn't come out and vote. P.S. I'm black and very, 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 very angry at all my friends. Angry. Thank you for Herman. Okay. Thank you, Herman, for that very important letter. And Barbara says, there's no adventure without the possibility of death. Okay, think about that for a minute. I go into the
next
gardens.
Letter.
There's no more letters. I go into the gardens and fix up my gardens, and I get bit by a tick, and there's a possibility of death.
But not now with your tick-proof pants.
My kids got me tick-proof pants.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they made of a particular fabric, or do they?
Fabric, which has been
treated.
Treated is the word I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Treated with anti-tick stuff.
Wow,
it repels them.
That's terrific.
Do you need a shirt to go with it? Like, do they migrate to the shirt?
They do migrate.
Okay.
They crawl right up your leg, and then you know, into unmentionable places.
Behind your knee.
Yeah, yeah, that and there too. And then, and my kids asked me, what would you say? They said, now, should we get you, should we also get you the shirt?
Yeah, well, that's my question.
And next Father's Day, we'll get you the shirt.
I said, no, 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 no. You know, don't spend that extra money. Bless your hearts.
Because you can, of course, buy your own shirt.
I can.
Well, to go with the pants.
I hadn't thought of it.
You know, have the whole ensemble.
A matching shirt.
That's right.
What color is the pair of pants?
I think Army Brown.
Army Brown, nice.
I think. Nice. Maybe not.
Huh, I just heard from Jordan. It was Rosemary saying, hey, can we move on to the next topic? I'm just guessing. Good morning. And okay, so let's go over to this, which is our next topic. And I want to talk to you about gerrymandering and the Supreme Court of the United States. I know, Alan, you've talked a lot about this, but the justices are going to hear a major challenge to partisan gerrymandering. They announced Monday that it would consider whether this partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution, potentially setting the stage for a ruling that would that could, for the first time, impose limits on a practice that has helped define American politics since the early days of the Republic.
Well, you know that Justice Frankfurter, all those years ago, said the courts had no business invading the political thicket. We should stay out of the political thicket. It's always been one of the great shames of American democracy that we allow these bums to draw their own districts where only they can win. It's that simple. It happens in New York. Of course, New York is a blue state, so even though the assembly does it, there's no question that they do it, it doesn't make the same kind of difference as the scramble to keep the Senate Republican, with the acquiescence, in my opinion, of this particular Democratic governor who likes it that way. It's a terrible, terrible story. And it needs to be stopped. It's that simple. Now, the key player here is Justice Kennedy, who has signaled in past decisions that if somebody could come up with a good way of defining what's over the top, he would vote with the anti-gerrymander people. And I suspect that's what's going to happen. I think we're going to see there's a new formula, and it has to do, to understand gerrymandering, you have to understand the way they do it. So let's say there are enough people in a particular area that could be two congressional districts. Are you all following me?
Yes, sir. I'm following. Yes, Professor.
Dr. Sharkey. So what they do is they take all the Democrats and they put them, if there would have been enough Democrats, in two districts to keep two. So they take all the Democrats and they put them in one, thereby saving the extra Republican district.
And making the Democrats waste their votes.
Well, do they ever do that for the Republican districts? Or is this just the Democrats' gerrymander?
It's a very cynical question that you ask. But I'm going to...
Because your example makes it seem like this is a Republicans' do this, but Democrats don't.
Well, as the way it turns out, that's exactly right. Because what's happened in the United States is that the Republicans have taken many of the state legislatures, and as soon as they do in a state like Texas, they wipe out most of the Democratic congressmen. That's what happened.
But a state like Texas, you would imagine most Republicans, they're going to be Republican congressmen in Texas anyway, correct?
Yeah, but there were lots of Democratic congressmen over the years in Texas because of the way things were. There was a guy named Brooks, as I remember it. He got wiped out, and so he was a lion of the House of Representatives.
So Democrats don't engage in gerrymandering.
Well, wait a second now, JP. You know full well that I said that the Democrats in the Assembly were doing it here, but that it didn't matter in this state that much because it's a very blue state.
Right. But that issue here is whether there could be a nonpartisan way, a different formula, a different way to cut up congressional districts without building in this political advantage.
Right. And you are right, because what I was going to try to remember to say here is that the formula that would make Kennedy happy would be to say, OK, we now have a mathematical formula, maybe an algorithm or whatever, that would say you can't take waste votes in more of the kind I just described. I know this is hard for everybody to follow, including me. But let's say you are now going to you have the possibility of two districts which have equal number of Democrats and Republicans, but you put all the Democrats in one district, or JP, to your point, all the Republicans in one district if the Democrats are doing it. Then there is this algorithm which shows you that if it goes over the a particular percentage in called wasted votes, that's the term that is being used, and they're hoping that this way of doing it, of coming up with an analysis of the way that people have done this, is a fair thing. Now, in New York State, we had a federal judge do the congressional districts, and it made a huge difference because you got a lot of fair fights. That's how FASO won.
It's a very challenging topic in that each legislature chooses the congressional districts, which makes it for 50 different states are making decisions, and it's all the politicians make the decisions, to your point.
That's right,
Alan. And it is a mathematical problem as much as a political problem, and I think our goal, I think, should be to have the most competitive congressional districts every 2 years.
Well said. The problem, JP, is that that's not the way these characters work. They have kept the Senate in blue state New York Republican all these years by gerrymandering like crazy. And
state Senate districts in New York are drawn in a very funny way.
You know how they do it? They go to the great computer on their wall in the computer room and they say, oh, mirror, mirror on the, no, computer, computer on the wall, draw me districts where we can't lose. And that's exactly what has been done until this time.
In New York, it's a particularly acute problem because you look at a year like last year, one incumbent out of all the assembly members and all the state senators, only one incumbent lost, which is disgusting in a year where I think that Skelos and Silver were convicted of corruption. We only had one incumbent representative lose. On the national level, at maximum, there are about 40 seats that are competitive, which can switch the balance of Congress.
Absolutely.
We've had this balance of Congress switch a number of times over the last 20 years.
I think it's 28 votes.
But it's right now it's 24, I read in the paper. But there are 40 seats that are up for grabs. There are 435 seats. So that means only 10% of the seats, 10% of the members of Congress have a competitive district, and 90% have safe seats where they can do whatever the heck they want. And hopefully there's a way where we can increase it to having 50 or 75 competitive seats in the Congress, which would be unbelievable. I don't know how you do it and who it would benefit, the Democrats or the Republicans.
It'd benefit the American people, arguably.
I agree.
All right. We're out of time.
I knew you were making signals about something.
No, we're out of time. But I want to thank everybody for being with us. A reminder that you can still write your notes. We love to see them. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller. I thank you all for being with us this morning. Very nice to have your thoughts on the air this morning. Excellent. We will be back with more Roundtable after this.